Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science. Whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere, we'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Welcome back to Deer University. Today is our 10th episode, gentlemen. So we have been downloaded all throughout North America and even a few foreign countries. So that's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
This is our 10th episode, and what we mentioned last time is that we were going to periodically do some question and answer. So today we're going to address some questions that came in on our website and a few social media questions that we saw in common. But to make you both feel good, I want to read a comment from Brad Parker. He says, I want to thank everyone at the Deer Lab for your hard work. I've been enjoying not only your Facebook posts, but also your podcast. The information you are putting out has been enlightening, to say the least. I look forward to hearing your next podcast. So, Steve, you're finally doing something right.
Thank you, Brad.
It's about time.
We sure appreciate it. It makes me feel good.
Well, Marcus, since you just spoke up, I'll ask you a question. Right. Probably one of the most popular comments we got was about your mineral stumps episode, where you explained how it worked and management-wise what to do. We got a lot of good feedback on that technique, but also a few more questions.
Yep.
So I'm going to read a few of them. We had one from Phil Holcomb, one from Philip McCain, as well as Sean Stoddard. And in general, I'm summarizing a little bit here, but does it matter as much what species you have? Do you need to concentrate on a particular species? And would you ever consider planting any of these tree species?
Yeah. Well, I'm very happy. There seems to be a big interest in the mineral stumps. And again, that's really rewarding for us here at the Deer Lab. And to address your last question first, I guess I'll go out of order. In most cases, you're going to have woody encroachment, whether it be in an old field or in a forest. You normally will have mid-story hardwood trees. So there's rarely a circumstance that I would consider planting that you normally just have plenty of trash trees, so to speak. I saw a comment on Facebook. Someone talked about they had plenty of trash trees. So if that's the way you want to think about it, you can turn that trash into some really good food by cutting it down. To take that a little further, we haven't tested this on every species. I have seen dozens of species respond in this way. Basically, if it's a species that you can cut down and it will resprout, the deer like it more than they did before you did that. There is a gradient. Sweet gum, I talked about seeing this on sweet gum. That doesn't mean sweet gum's the best thing out there. You know, that may not be the species you want to target, but it still, they do like sweet gum stump sprouts more than they do just sweet gum seedlings. So probably the best species that I have seen to date is black gum. They like black gum anyway. So that's really the way I would think about it. If they like it as a seedling and you create a mineral stump out of it, it goes off the charts in selectivity.
They're going to like it even more.
Absolutely. And, you know, like black gum, this has been happening a long time to black gum. Fire top kills it. It gets blown over by wind, a hurricane, you know, you name it. Trees have adapted to deal with this response, and black gum is one of those species that knows it's going to have to deal with heavy herbivory So it takes a really aggressive strategy to deal with that. And because of that, it produces a ton of foliage, and deer just keep coming back for it more and more. So that's one that I think that's the one that sticks out to me that you should target. It's also a tree that's it's not usually valuable from a timber standpoint. So that's a great one to target. But, you know, red maples, yellow poplar, I've even seen it on Osage orange or Bodock, some people call it.
You had a beech for four years.
Yeah, American beech. That's something that's normally poor quality, and I've watched them eat the same stump for years.
And it's found most everywhere.
Yeah, found most everywhere. So I want to reiterate, we haven't tested everything, but I've yet to find a species that they will not use if it's stump spreads. So don't let that limit you, that we haven't tested everything. Try it out. You know, we're actually considering a protocol that we could implement at a large scale. You know, a lot of people don't realize that we're doing this for the hunters, but we also need help from the hunters as well. And we'd like to implement this project at a larger scale. And we're trying to figure out a way to do that effectively where the hunters can help us gather data so that we can bring you better information.
You had a hunter from hunter/manager from Kansas.
Yep.
I know I saw that thread back and forth between you two, and you advised him on a protocol.
Yep, a simple protocol. And again, we're working out the details on that because those things also cost money. And research isn't free. We've got to figure out a way to fund it.
A comment that Chris LeMaster said was, again, Marcus, wanting to know about specific species. In this case, he was in northern Missouri. Mm-hmm. But if I'm hearing you correctly, it's probably wherever you go. Well, we know wherever you go, there's going to be hardwood trees.
Yep.
And from what you've seen in your experience from Mississippi to Tennessee to North Carolina and just about everywhere in between, you have seen this phenomenon on every hardwood species. Yep. Now, there's been some preference maybe to more.
Yeah,
but you've still seen this browsing on everyone, every species.
Every species. Some of them are, you know, like sweet gum. I keep going back to that one because it's so surprising. Now, if you cut down hundreds of trees, let's just say, for instance, they're not going to eat the sweet gum resprouts in that case. They don't need to. They've got mineral stumps everywhere. They're going to pick the ones they like most. But if sweet gum is the only one, then they'll eat it then. I've watched them do it several times, and I'm always amazed. And, you know, we're talking about species, and we're only talking about trees. I've also watched this happen on vines, and there are perennial forbs that resprout if you top kill them. It seems to work on all of them.
Well, that brings up a good follow-up, Marcus, because we had a question from Freddie Walter in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and he was talking about, you know, he's more of a typical landowner. Well, he's like me. He leases property, I think, but he is not able to burn.
Yep.
So he doesn't own the forest, but he hunts the forest, and he's not able to burn. What he was wondering is, could he maybe incorporate bush hogging or mowing in between some of these rows of trees to maybe get a similar effect?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know what the biologists listening in are thinking, and they may disagree with my answer a little bit, but let me caveat. Normally, as a biologist, we would not recommend bush hogging or mowing for a habitat management tool. And that's because usually it doesn't promote the structure that we're looking for, especially with cover. And for a lot of wildlife species, it just doesn't promote the right forbs and things that you would be looking for.
We typically disc and burn.
Yeah, disc
and burn. But if you got a property where you can't do that.
Absolutely. And this is going to be a growing problem. The more people there are, the harder it's going to become to burn, and this is going to become more and more of a problem. So a lot of that knee-jerk, it's been beaten into my head for years and years that you don't mow for wildlife management. But that was before we had this information about mineral stumps. And if you mow a couple of rows in your pines, maybe you want to stand there or you just want to have some high-quality nutrition, cutting those things, those tree saplings off or whatever else you cut off, and having them mineral stump, it's just as good as cutting them down with a chainsaw. So even if you have, you know, maybe you have heavy duty equipment, you can really get some good sized saplings, or even if it's just a regular old bush hog and you're mowing through, you still could get some benefit. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, a couple of yards long. I'm talking about a couple hundred yards probably where you're really getting a benefit from it. But I could see a real advantage to, you know, not over fire, but if you don't have fire in your arsenal, using mowing to do this could be pretty important for your deer.
And can't you see that as a good stopping point, a deer moving through a forest?
Absolutely, and especially during bow season.
During bow season,
yeah. They're walking through that forest and they get out into that mowed strip and they're going to sit there for a few minutes.
And unbeknownst to them, yeah, the predator awaits.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks, Marcus. Steve, our second most common theme in the comments we received was about supplemental feeding. And we, the MSU Deer Lab, has never promoted supplemental feeding as the primary source of nutrition or as the way to improve diet quality. We say habitat number one. We prefer food plots number two, but we certainly recognize there's a place for supplemental feed. If you don't mind, why don't you just kind of give us your philosophy on when you would recommend? Do you recommend doing it 12 months out of the year, only during the nutritionally limited or stressful periods of the year, and the density at which you put it out? What's your philosophy on that?
Well, that's a great series of questions, Bronson, and I thank the listeners that are sending these in, and certainly we want to address it as completely as possible. There's so many "it depends" and contextual things that we need to clarify. First off, even applying to the mineral stump question, is nutrition limiting the population? And in most cases, it is. So anything you do to improve the nutrition, the intake of nutrition by the deer, you're going to benefit. You're going to be able to grow larger deer, grow larger antler deer, increase reproductive rates perhaps, if you apply enough additional nutrition to remove it as a limiting factor. So improved nutrition is a great thing. The benefit of doing it with habitat is you are adding structure as well as nutrition. So physical fire and disking is adding that structural component. So that's why we like to promote habitat management over feeding per se, pouring the protein content out of the bag. But again, if you're a landowner, or if you're not a landowner and you can't manage the habitat and you have a limited amount of space and time, supplemental feeding is certainly an option. Now, I'm going to start rambling. I warn you right now, Bronson, thump me over the head or flick something at me.
I'll edit the audio file. Okay. I'll just cut out the ramble.
Okay. remove the ramble as needed. Supplemental feeding can, if done correctly, improve the nutritional intake. Now, commonly, hunters want to say, I want to know, when should I feed? And question is not when, it's how much and how long you should be feeding. If you're going to feed, you need to feed year-round. Pour feed out into a feeder, the deer that need it aren't going to just go up and start eating it in quantity, in enough quantity, immediately. So feeding, supplemental feeding, is a learned trait. We did a study back in Texas years ago. It took over 2 years of year-round supplemental feeding with a pretty dense feeder density, I think it was about 125 acres per feeder. Over 2 years, only 50% of the deer population were at that point eating feed. So they have to learn to eat the feed. So you can't just put it out for a month or two and then expect it to fix a problem and then stop it until the next year when you think you're going to have another problem. So one of the important factors to remember is if you're going to feed, it needs to be year-round and let the deer decide when they need it. The fancy French or Latin term we use is ad libitum, as much as they need. How do you deliver it? A feeder that is protecting the feed from the wind, from the rain in particular, is critical, and you don't want it on the ground directly. That minimizes the disease potential, parasites in particular, by having feed on the ground. Negative side of supplemental feeding: anytime you concentrate animals artificially, you're going to increase the disease potential. Parasites from ground, fecal deposition, internal parasites, feed being eaten off the ground where feces are being defecated, and you got a disease problem waiting to happen. And some of the more infectious diseases like chronic wasting disease and vector transmitted diseases like hemorrhagic disease are still increased in prevalence potentially when you increase deer concentration around a feeder. So spreading nutritional improvement around the habitat by managing habitat doesn't artificially concentrate the deer. Feeding will artificially concentrate deer, and I'm rambling way too much.
Well, let me cut your ramble. A moment ago you said vector transmitted diseases.
Yes.
Explain what you meant by a vector.
All right. A vector is a biting insect, typically a mosquito, a midge, or a tick that bites an animal and then transmits the disease that that animal might have to another animal that doesn't have the disease. Now, there's different types of, there's physical vectors, there's a lot of terminology we could get into, but I don't want to do that. A vector just transmits a disease.
It's the source of the disease.
It's a transmitting of a disease. The source would be the animal that it got it from, and then the vector physically transmits it to another.
So there has to be a middleman between two individuals. So one deer isn't directly giving it to another deer. There's something in the middle.
Yes, some vectors actually have physical development of the disease within them. Some are purely a mechanical transfer of the disease. That gets into the different terminology. But the point being, insects typically transferring a disease.
I've got a couple questions for you guys to comment on. One is from Kurt Myers. He asked about, and I think we talked about this a great deal in our environment versus genetics, our nutrition versus genetics and epigenetics, but if he starts feeding, will I be able to notice a difference in deer antler size? And so I'll start with yes, but it may take a long time to see. So was there a nutritional deficiency to begin with?
Mm-hmm.
Is the amount of feed provided going to substantially improve diet quality? And then if that is the case, yes, there will be some small incremental changes year one, year two, but really you're talking about year five and up to year 10 to when you see these intergenerational, the switches being turned on.
I think it's important also that it's not on the individual you already have there. It's on his offspring.
Right.
That's why it takes so long. I'm talking about a yearling buck eating through its life and being a great 7 or 8 year old because of that. I mean, it probably would improve, but the real big jump comes from the epigenetic through offspring.
Long-term supplemental feeding can benefit if there is a nutritional limitation, and there usually is, but the amount of impact may be a bit of a disappointment.
It's proportional to how much you feed. It is proportional to the nutrition.
Yes.
So if diet quality is really limited and you add a little supplemental feed, you're probably not ever going to see a response. And so regarding Kurt's question, another part, Steve and Marcus, is that, and we hear this a lot in our Delta region, our ag region, probably in the Midwest as well, is that if you're in a landscape dominated by agriculture, do you need to supplementally feed year-round? And so what a lot of people will do is they won't supplementally feed until it's wintertime, until deer season is over, and they're just carrying deer over until spring green up. So do you agree with that philosophy? If you were in an ag landscape, and let's say an ag landscape dominated by alfalfa, soybeans, things like that, would you need to supplementally feed during the summer?
Probably not. But if you're not, and then you slap a feeder out there and put some feed in it, the deer aren't going to know what that feeder and feed are for potentially weeks or months. And if deer are not trained to go to the feeder, or if they don't learn behaviorally that there's feed there, and the way that that happens is through young deer being taken to a feeder by an older deer, usually the mother, and they learn through experience that the feeder is present and there's good stuff in it. And so just sticking out a feeder at the end of the ag production season isn't, in my mind, an effective way to supplementally feed. The problem with all that is, the problem with what I'm saying here is the cost. It's very expensive to supplementally feed. So, you know, I don't want to sit around here and just talk about the cons of supplemental feeding. It can be a beneficial experience if you do enough of it, and if the deer need it, and the deer get it for long enough time, but you have to be willing to pay the price, and that's a big, problem.
It seems like to me it's not just a short-term cost. Even to get to where you start realizing the benefit that you get, if it's in the context that you get it, that's a big financial investment to get that far down the road to even realize the benefits.
That's right. Talk about return on investment. Talk to your financial planner about return on investment.
Well, what about, what do you look for in a supplemental feed? So another question we got here was, look at all the different types of feed that's sold, all the marketing that's done with it. So, Steve, what would you look for on the tag of a bag? What are you looking for a good feed?
The primary consideration is protein content. And what you're doing is trying to supplement the native vegetation. And so if the native vegetation is, averaging 10 or 12% protein on the browse component, and you're trying to supplement that to support late-term gestation or lactation demand or late-term antler growth, and you want 16 or 18%, you need to be well above the native vegetation. They're not going to eat just supplemental feed. Even in our pens, in our research facility, we have 10 deer within an acre or two fenced research pen. They don't eat just pelleted feed. We have to provide them with an environment that they can forage in, because it's in their head.
That's what deer do.
They forage, yeah.
That's, they're designed to get their nutrients out
from
of
plants.
Vegetation.
Yes.
Wow. One thing I wanted to reiterate there, you talked about the 10 to 12% crude protein in browse in general, and that's accurate unless you're burning or disking or top killing plants and, the mineral stumps, for instance, the red maples, we had 20 out of 100 or something like that were over 20% protein.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we've taken that 10 to 12% and doubled it or more in some of those trees, and the same thing happens after fire.
Yeah.
doesn't cost that much to burn a pretty large scale. So just a thought to keep in mind since we've been talking about both of those topics.
Yeah.
One more question. This one's from Jason Hooper regarding supplemental feed. And guys, we get this one all the time. If you're going to engage in this type of program, do you feed corn or do you feed protein pellets?
Good question. Corn provides energy. Energy can be important, but most important in my mind and most often limiting to a deer population is protein. So I worry more about protein than I do energy. If they meet their protein requirements, generally they'll have enough energy along the way. But you can greatly exceed the energy requirements and not have enough protein. So protein first, then energy.
You know, and typically, if you're in a place where there's any substantial amount of acorns, they're getting a lot of energy from acorns as well.
That's right.
So acorns are low in protein, high in energy. So they're getting that energy from acorns. A comment also that Jason mentioned was, we hear this one a lot too, is summer food plots versus your cool season, you know, hunting food plots. And Jason mentioned that some of the people he hunted with, they don't really want to invest in, you know, these warm season plots because they're not going to get to see the deer using it or harvest deer over it. But to me, you've got two different questions there. Both of those are critically important. Now, if all you want to do is see deer to increase observation rates and hunting opportunity, then just do your cool season. Just do your fall, wintertime plots, and that's for seeing deer. But it's also improving nutrition. If, though, you are trying to truly raise diet quality for the deer population, then, yeah, you got to do the warm season plots as well. So do you need to do both? Well, it depends. It depends on if you want to improve the diet quality of the deer herd. And if you want to do that, then yeah, you got to do both of them. So yeah. Great questions.
Yeah, and I like to emphasize it's not just warm season versus cool season. There's also that transition time when you're going from a warm season to a cool season forages. You've got some dead time in there. So I like to have some perennials also so that there's perennials are not great all the time, and you might be able to outproduce with an annual compared to a particular perennial, but the perennial provides that
carryover
in between the warm and the cool season.
Mm-hmm. And that typically is the stress period because the native vegetation is in that transition as well. Mm-hmm. So it really is important if you're trying to improve nutrition to make sure that you're addressing the stress period that's already naturally going to happen on the landscape. So late summer, late winter, typically in the south, we worry more about the late summer.
Mm-hmm. And some people talk about, back to the question of vectors and the disease, I wish there was a simple fix for vectors and diseases that you could put into supplemental feed. And make, you know, if you add that benefit to the feeding program, then that would help that whole feeding question. But there's not currently a really good fix for that. I mean, there are nematicides to control nematodes. There are chemical products. There are chemical
stuff
products
you can buy
that can be added to supplemental feed to help with some of the disease issues.
Well, let's keep going with that, Steve, because we have two questions, one from Eddie Jones and one from Doug Hewitt about ticks. And so that's one thing now when we have all these trail cameras on the landscape, people are seeing ticks on deer during the summertime. So both these people were wanting to know, is there anything they can do about when they see this heavy tick load? And they're probably seeing it on the ears and neck and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
What can people do about that?
Well, there's some effective tick treatment devices that are used to control ticks to minimize Lyme disease impacts in suburban urban interfaces, you know, around towns. And if you can get deer to come to these, basically a supplemental feeder, you can apply a contact chemical product at the feeder that will help control the ticks.
It has like a vertical post. It's almost like you see it with some of the cattle feeders when they put their head in. It applies some of it on their ears and they absorb it.
Yes.
Now, you guys know that we can't go through that topic without me throwing in the habitat plug.
Absolutely.
There was recently a study in South Georgia that showed that fire decreases the abundance of ticks on the landscape, and that, you know, that vector decreases in density and won't be as much of a problem.
Absolutely.
So you're getting another thing out of fire.
Yet another benefit of fire.
So couldn't let you go on through that topic without throwing that in there.
Right with you, brother.
So, Steve, just to give these people some advice, short of installing one of these contraptions, and I know what you're referring to, there's a name for it, the four post such and such system, I'm drawing a blank on it, but there is a technique and a chemical and a design that goes with that. Short of that, are deer going to make it through? Deer been dealing with ticks for a long time?
They have been, and you know, we typically don't see a heavy tick load during the wintertime because the ticks have dropped off and they're doing what we call estivation or diapause, overwinter diapause is the proper term.
Is that kind of like a hibernation?
Basically hibernating, yeah. So you don't typically see them when you're hunting, but yeah, they're ticks and even the biting flies like horseflies, midges, mosquitoes are drawing a whole lot of blood out of the animals. And yet these animals have been successful over eons, so it's not like there's a critical issue, but there have been studies way back in a way back study of significant fawn mortality out in Oklahoma from tick burdens, summer tick loads,
That's
killing high percentage of fawns.
It must have been way back.
Way back, way back, and tying in to the prescribed fire can fix that kind of a problem as well.
Sure, and just a little fun fact, I'm not sure if you guys even know yet, but we just had a paper accepted showing that for you bird enthusiasts out there, that eastern phoebes will actually ride around on deer and eat ticks off of them. We had video evidence from some of the camera studies right here in Mississippi. And again, eastern phoebes love open pine stands that have been thinned and burned. And sure enough, we had evidence of phoebes using deer to forage. So just a fun fact. I don't know what scale that happens at, but pretty interesting that that happens at all.
Okay, so if one of our two or several, there might be hundreds of listeners that not only are interested in deer, but they maybe phoebes are high on their list.
If you're a bird enthusiast, there's certainly plenty of those around.
Absolutely.
One of my buddies, Mick Hellickson, when we were in school in South Texas together, he had a beautiful photograph on the Welder Wildlife Refuge, open landscape, and it was just beautiful. I think it was even a 10-pointer, but a phoebe was perched on his antler. So that might have been perching there and feeding off of the buck's back.
Well, ours was actually sitting on a female deer, sitting right on her back, and we had videos of the phoebe flying up off the back and preening the side of the deer to get the ticks off.
Last question. This one is from Eddie Higgins, and it's about EHD. Would treating free-ranging deer with permethrin, given a low-impact way of applying it, reduce the transmissions of EHD from biting flies that carry it? Steve or Marcus, have y'all ever heard of a way of treating a free-ranging herd with a chemical like that?
Well, that would help probably with the tick problem. But the biting midges aren't going to be impacted by that, I don't think. We use, in our deer research facility, we spray permethrin in the evenings to control midges, to control loss due to hemorrhagic disease. And it's, you know, we're doing that 2 to 3 times a week, basically every other night, and we still lose deer to hemorrhagic disease. So it's a difficult, probably not feasible to treat deer in the wild for controlling EHD.
Yeah. It's just, it's an issue of scale. Just wouldn't be feasible to do it.
When, Steve, you're the disease expert out of us.
We're speaking relatively then.
Well, so with EHD, it's been such an important driver of deer populations, especially in the South and Mid-South, for so long. And they've been getting along with it for quite a while. And because it's cyclic, so in other words, we have the cyclic nature of the disease, you'll have outbreaks and then go a couple of years and then have another outbreak. Is it something, if you could control it, would you want to?
Good question. I think most hunters would want to, because hunters never see enough deer. As a wildlife biologist, I'm typically seeing too many deer. And so I think that's where you're getting at is, do we want to control the mortality rates and have more deer than we already have? And that's a good philosophical question.
I read one paper, and I know just enough about this topic to be dangerous. I read a paper on innate resistance of fawns, where mothers were actually passing resistance to fawns.
Mm-hmm.
So if you did control it on the landscape, and let's say we did that for 10 years, and then maybe the property changed ownership or something happened, what would happen to that resistance?
Oh, yeah, spring right back next time it came through. Mm-hmm. And then these serotypes or varieties of EHD, there's half a dozen or more in the United States, mm-hmm. and they cycle through every few years.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you don't have resistance to the next one that comes in, you're going to have a much more serious.
So you may have a much larger part of your population may die, but the individuals that make it then would start passing that resistance on again.
Yeah, we had a really large impact from EHD6, which was a variety, a serotype of it that hit the United States. It was an exotic variety. EHD6 hit in, I think it was 2010 initially, and a big impact in 2012, 2013, and that impact has spread north into the northern United States as the vector and the disease has spread over the years, and populations have to adapt to these new varieties, and then they'll be okay against that variety, but then a few years later, a new serotype will come through, or one of the previous serotypes that haven't been around for a while will come back through and spank the herd again.
Steve, isn't there a general relationship with these viruses are more common in southern deer and not as common in northern deer? Doesn't that explain why we typically see less devastation or less mortality in deer in southern latitudes versus northern latitudes?
Yeah, the prevalence of the diseases have been greater in the south, and so the deer have adapted to these diseases, and so they're less susceptible to them. And as these diseases have been spreading north in the last 10 or 12 years, there are much more significant impacts in northern deer populations, and that's another reason why we tell landowners don't try to bring northern deer into the south, because you think you're going to improve the genetics. What you're doing is bringing deer that aren't susceptible to our southern diseases, and they're going to be more apt to die from them.
That's interesting. So some of the stuff I've read about the disease, it seems like, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like more than 90% of the deer in the deep south are exposed to EHD. So they have the titers where they've responded to being exposed to it.
At any point in time, most of the deer have been exposed to one or more of the serotypes.
Yeah.
And it's not until the new serotype, or one that they're not exposed to, comes in another 2 or 3 years that you can have a more significant impact.
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting disease.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to wrap up with one last comment. Marcus, you're going to like this. From Dayton Brush. First of all, a compliment. I just wanted to take a second and let you know I think the information you all have provided so far has been priceless. He then says, habitat management is everything.
It's a good man.
So I know that tickles your fancy there. One of his questions that we might need to let the old buck answer is he's wanting to know, as the buck reaches a certain age, he says, let's say 10 years old, or it could be 6 or 12, that the belief that a buck's antlers will start to shrink considerably. So, Steve, we've had some great examples in the deer research facility over the year, but do you want to go over kind of the general trends from the scientific literature about maximum age and how long antler size? Is that kind of that maximum before it may decline?
Yeah, this is really a topic that we've learned enough about in the last 10 years to really rethink what we've been teaching hunters. You know, 20 and 30 years ago, it was get them to 5 years of age and you'll have them as big as possible. Well, back when there were only 2 and 3 year old bucks around, getting to 5 years was a great target. But now we know that antler size really, in a free-ranging population, won't maximize until about 6 and sometimes even 7 years of age. And so we're not in as much of a rush to harvest a mature deer as we used to be, because they're not fully matured until 6 or so years of age. And then if nutrition is stable, we don't have that annual huge swings from year to year, then the quality of his antlers will remain high through until the last year or so of his life. And that could be 11 or 12 years of age if he's not harvested. And so as the more mature buck in the room right now, who's still in fine shape, my antlers are, they're growing as big this year as they have any other year.
You're a cull now, Steve. You're a cull.
I'm a cull?
Yeah.
Mm. I'm not over the hill. And I will prove it this fall. I will have as polished, shiny a set of antlers as anyone in this room.
Good thing this is audio only, huh?
Yes.
Good thing there's no video to go along with
as
it.
As you've pointed out, I have a great face for radio.
Yeah.
And
a voice for newsprint.
Yes, and my antlers would go along with it.
I will remind everyone that there are videos of you on our Facebook page.
Well, that's right. That's right.
But better put up or shut up.
To get to the facts again, if nutrition is good, antler size will not decline until that animal is literally running out of teeth to eat his nutrition, to eat his diet.
So we saw firsthand with one of our really high-quality bucks, one of our superstars, he grossed well over 200 inches of antler from 5 to 10. And he may have done it for another 2 or 3 years. It's just unfortunate that he died for other reasons. But at 10 years of age, he was still over 200 inches of Boone and Crockett.
Yeah. He was a good quality buck, and he remained with a stable diet. Didn't go down. And he's, you know, we don't like to talk about individual animals because we don't manage individual animals. But on average, whatever a buck can grow and maximize out at, they will stay stable. There's no rush to judgment. If you think a buck might be not quite mature yet, his antlers aren't going to go down the next year. Give him another chance. Unless, of course, he might die of EHD.
You always roll the dice to some degree.
It's a roll of the dice. Does he have that wow factor, as our friend Randy likes to say? Hey, he doesn't like to worry about specific antler criteria and antler sizes. If he has that wow factor, when you see him, you know him,
mm-hmm.
and it's time to harvest him.
That's right.
Well, along those same lines, just really quick, I always hear about that old barren doe. Is that an old wives' tale? Or?
Absolutely. That's one of my favorite wives' tales to dissipate.
Myth-busting here.
Yes. Does, is until they run out of teeth to eat their food, they can continue producing babies, just like the bucks can continue producing antlers as long as they have stable diet quality.
Well, guys, we just wrapped up our 10th episode.
Feels good.
So far, so good. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, and so let's see, what's the 10th anniversary? Are you giving us presents?
Why don't you take us out for ice cream, Mr. Ice Cream Man?
Well, that's a diet quality issue, and we'll talk about that after the mic gets turned off.
Okay, everyone, thanks for tuning in. We have enjoyed it, and hope you tune in next week. We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.